All right, welcome back. Today we're in the, I want to say in the studio, but we're on Skype with Dr. Kelly, Chief Medical Officer of Improvada. Welcome in.
Hey guys, how you doing? Glad to be here.
All right, before we get started, Larry is going to go through the gauntlet with Dr. Kelly, and we'll get to know him a little bit.
All right.
Bring it on, Larry.
All right, let's do it. You ready? All right, so married or single?
Married.
Any children?
Yeah, three lovely children.
All right. City you live in?
Brookline, Massachusetts.
Brookline, Massachusetts. That's just outside of Boston, or?
The mean streets, the hood, Brookline, Mass.
All right.
We're technically in Norfolk County and not part of Boston, but I'm about a mile and a half from Fenway Park. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm pretty much
that's
in the
Boston.
Middle of Boston.
I feel like that would be Boston, yeah.
Have you lived there a long time?
Yeah, 2001.
You don't have an accent, though. You don't have the Boston accent, I feel like.
Smat Pack, Wicked Pack, and Cambridge, haven't yet.
You've been there long enough to pull it out.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I can turn it on or off. It's a weapon at my disposal, but I choose not to use it most of the time.
Okay.
Are you then a huge Red Sox fan?
And big Red Sox fan. We'll get to some of the stuff I've done, but one of the interesting things is the place where I'm an ER doctor, Beth Israel Deaconess in Boston, well, we have the contract for Fenway Park. So we're actually the first aid physicians for Fenway.
Oh, cool.
I've been to a whole bunch of games, working games, you know, lots of stories there. And it's been really fun. But we were running medical control there all through those years when they finally came back and beat the dreaded Yankees. And I've been to a World Series game working one of those.
Oh,
and
that's
it's
cool.
Been a lot of fun. Yeah. Yeah. So that's I grew cool. up a Sox fan. And it's fun poking around the stadium. It solidifies my theory that if you have a walkie-talkie and you look like you know what you're doing, you can get just about anywhere in the world.
yeah. I agree with
that's
that.
That's the recipe for success right there.
Yes. I like that. All right. I like that.
I'm going to buy a walkie-talkie this weekend.
You got to know what you look like. You got to know what you look like you know what you're doing too, though.
Right?
Yeah,
Larry. Look, collared shirts tucked in, you know, put it on the hip.
And just keep walking, right? And if somebody is going to say something, I just pretend like I'm a walkie-talkie.
Yes,
inform them.
a little high volume squelch out of that thing, and they'll be convinced it's all good.
Yeah, I'll have either Jeremy or Corey in the car ready to beep at a beep. You know,
we just stand next to each other and talk to the walkie-talkie to each other. So, Dr. Kelly, not to go too deep on this, but are you a Patriots fan as well?
Absolutely.
And so, how do you feel about Tom coming down to my Bucks?
Is that you're a Bucks guy. You know, it's funny. Yeah.
It's hard. You can't brag about it. I mean, I'm with the Bucks. We're not, you know, it's been since you.
You finally got him, and who knows if we'll even have a season. We'll see.
Yeah, he could get sacks game one and be done. You don't know.
I don't know.
We might not have a season from the Coronas.
That's a good point.
It's gonna be hard to change their whole offense to suit Tom's style. That's a tough one to just play.
I think I'm looking forward to hopefully his leadership. Like if he can bring that mentality in, that'll be a big piece. Anyway,
I think he needed to change a scene personally. I'm sad to lose him. I think he's the best player to ever play the game. Pleasure to watch him play.
All right. So moving on. So iPhone or Android?
I'm an iPhone guy, which I don't know. I kind of wish I was an Android guy, but I started using iPhones and the whole family's got iPhones. So I'm
they
iPhone.
Just suck you in. They just suck you
in.
Yeah, I
just been
out.
In there for a while.
Yeah.
So why do you wish you were an Android guy? Like what's the reason?
I feel like iPhones just keeps taking me to more expensive place and it bugs the crap out of me. And they try to tell me what features are good for me, and I don't like some of their features and their changes and the forced upgrades. I wish I had a little more flexibility. I'm an early tech adopter. I'm not really super savvy, but I'm tech curious, I guess, and I like to have some control. I like to have some control over
I like
some
that
of the
term.
Stuff that I want tech to curious, play yeah. around with. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
Start using it.
Apple thinks they know it's good for me, and a lot of times they're right, but sometimes they're not because I have like a very, I have a bunch of different jobs, and then I have a bunch of different kind of my kids and social life and everything. It's just there's a lot of stuff going on, So to have a little bit more control over those interfaces would be kind of nice.
I agree.
I totally agree as well. Favorite movie or book?
Oh, dude, favorite movie is such a hard one. I think, Shawshank Redemption, that kind of thing. You have the expression, you get Shawshanked, you know, if you're watching cable and that comes up. Yeah. That's obviously a great one. As far as comedies, I actually just watched A Hangover with the kids, which was hysterical.
Okay.
There's a whole bunch of other ones. Yeah, the first Hangover.
Yeah.
That's the best one.
You know, like a Monty Python guy, like the Monty Python.
Yeah.
Like that kind of stuff. There's a ton of great movies, but it's just too hard to say just one favorite movie. You got to go with categories, and even then, it's a deep list. Yeah.
Yes.
Those are just a couple.
All right. Favorite genre of music?
Well, it's funny. I kind of like alternative, but I also like old school rap and stuff. So there's a whole, it kind of runs the gamut there too. And it totally depends on the mood. So I'm a big fan of like a playlist that varies like a whole lot.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you on that.
I feel like those two come up a lot, like alternative rock, and then people always mention alternative rock, they always mention old school rap. I feel like those two, it must have been like the time timing. Yeah. They just came up together.
I think it's the formative years, right? Like when like grunge came up and turned into alternative and got more kind of folksy, guitar-y. And then at the same time, there was like NWA and Public Enemy and like, you know, Snoop Dogg and all that. So it's like a weird, it's a weird combo, but that was like, you know, for me, that was like high school into college and med school, which was like a lot of fun music and a lot of live shows. And I did my ER training at Vanderbilt down in Nashville. So I had this other kind of weird influence where like, I'm not a country guy, but like live music was everywhere you went there. Oh, and a little bit of like country influence and really talented musicians giving their twist on alternative. And then like, I loved going to New Orleans too. So there was that kind of whole Zydeco jazz like influence into it. So I'm a weird kind of, as far as music, I like a lot of different stuff.
I can certainly appreciate that. That's kind of how we all are on this podcast.
I agree.
The only exception for me is country for whatever reason. I can't get into it for the most part. However, I can get into some bluegrass. So, whatever. All right.
Who's running the gauntlet now? Are you running the gauntlet? I guess we're running you on the gauntlet now. Yeah. what's your favorite movie?
Me? What's my favorite movie? I don't know. Honestly, I haven't thought about it.
That's funny. We have talked about putting each other through the gauntlet because we haven't done that.
We have. Yeah.
Not so easy, is it, boys?
No.
I'll have to think about that one. All right. So reservation or just walk-in?
Well, walk-in, totally. I have a funny story about that, too. My wife and I, we were in Australia, and we were actually in Tasmania off the coast of Australia way back for our honeymoon years ago. And we were walking around and we didn't want to make a reservation because we didn't know any of the restaurants. We didn't know when we wanted to eat. We just kind of wanted to go and do whatever we wanted to do. So we'd kind of roll up on a restaurant and we'd figure out like that was kind of the place. The menu looked good. The vibe was cool. Like, you know, can we get a table for two? And a lot of times you're like, well, do you have a reservation? And you'd look around. And there's barely any people in the place. And so we're like, no. And we finally figured out all we had to say was like, if it was like 8:45, we'd be like, can we make one for table for two at 8:50? And they'd be like, yeah, sure, no problem. Come on in. So that was the best of both worlds. We didn't have to make a reservation. We just figured out we'd make one for T plus 2 minutes. And it's all good.
So maybe we start using that from now on. Whenever we are waiting, we'll be like, well, can I make one for 5 minutes from now?
It worked.
All right. So favorite movie for me, I guess if you put me on the spot, I would think Man on Fire, maybe. It's a great movie.
Really?
That's cool. That's a great movie. It's a great
movie. Yeah.
I can appreciate that, Larry.
It's just up there. I don't know.
Like, it's got Denzel, who's phenomenal. The storyline to that's pretty cool. Yeah.
Forrest Gump's up there as well. All right. Favorite type of
those are good. Yeah. Go ahead.
What was that?
I just make a notes, Man on Fire, because I gotta watch that movie now.
Oh, okay. You've never seen it?
No, I'm psyched.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Right. Favorite type of food?
Again, I like a whole bunch of different kinds. I love sushi, so that's probably the one that, that jumps up highest. But my go-to is a turkey sandwich, like, you know, toasted, melted, some sharp cheddar cheese, lettuce, tomato, some hots, like that. I'm a turkey sandwich guy. Like, if I had to take one food to a desert island and eat it the rest of my life, it'd be like turkey sandwich. Now, dessert-wise,
bacon or no?
No. Well, no. I mean, I like it with bacon, but I don't need the bacon. I'm all about the usually smoked turkey, sharp cheddar cheese, toasted, melted.
It's very specific. Lettuce, tomato. I like it.
Yeah. No, I got lots of variations, but that's my go-to. I could eat hundreds of those things. Now, dessert-wise, it's mint chocolate chip ice cream. By far.
Okay. Now, is
turkey from a specific spot?
What's that?
Is it turkey from a specific spot, or is it?
No, that's like I can do that anywhere. I got a bunch of places around town that I like, but and usually it's like Italian sandwich shops kind of thing. But no, that's my like at home. I can make a mean turkey sandwich.
The name is escaping me right now, but there's a spot out there that makes the turkey terrific. It's phenomenal.
Yeah. Keep going. I'll probably remember it.
I'll get that answer here in a few, but yeah, it's really good. All right, Jeremy, were you gonna say something?
Yeah.
Nope.
Oh, I'm good. Go ahead. Sushi. Now, I don't really like sushi, but I try it every time I get the opportunity because I'm always like, one time I'm gonna like it. Like, what's one type of sushi that you like that you're like, oh, this would be the best thing to eat? Like, for somebody that doesn't like sushi.
That doesn't like sushi, that's hard, right? Because it's like you either go all in or you kind of don't. But if you get a shrimp tempura roll, that's fried shrimp, which it's pretty hard not to like that.
Yeah, that one's not
that's
bad.
Probably what you got to do. And spicy tuna is another one.
Like a dragon roll, it's kind of warm. Because sometimes that's a nice segue into like sushi if you haven't done it. Larry, I think, is it Nelio's?
Nelio's.
Nelio's.
Yeah, I've never been there. I've heard it. It sounds really good. The turkey terrific is kind of like a Thanksgiving turkey kind of thing, which isn't my usual turkey maneuver. Yeah, because it's stuffing and cranberry and all that. I like it, but that's not my like favorite thing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's piled high with hand-carved roasted turkey, stuffing, and cranberries.
So good. It's so good. It's ridiculous. All right. So what do you drive?
So I drive a Jeep Wrangler, the soft top for four door. It's actually standard too. It's not automatic. It makes it
a man
fun
of
to drive.
What, old school. What year is it?
2015, I believe.
Nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
Corey's a hardcore car guy.
I'm not like a big car guy, but I like my cars to be fun. So like, and then the toy I would probably get would be the Tesla. Like the S, the super ludicrous Tesla, like, because I think an electric car that can, like, I think that would just be really cool.
I appreciate that it's a manual. You don't drive, or you don't mind driving a manual. So
yeah, I actually like it,
especially in the city.
I was gonna say in traffic.
Yeah, I had a 2013 four door Jeep with a manual.
Yeah, we leave the soft top on all year round, which is kind of stupid too, but we just kind of like it. So.
All right, so last question, beer, whiskey, or wine?
Oh, that's funny. So I'm going to actually give you the honest truth. I'm more a vodka guy. And I tend to drink sort of girly drinks sometimes. And it's very funny because like we'll go out and we'll get drinks and sometimes they'll bring like my wife, like her, they'll bring the drinks out and give the girly drink to her. I drink some vodka drinks. I do like whiskey. When I drink whiskey, I like the smoky stuff, like Lagavulin, Frag, like that kind of stuff. Wine, I like wine a lot, but the red wine sometimes gives me a little bit of a headache. So I like it, but I don't drink as much as I used to. When I'm in Europe and Italy and Spain and stuff, it's phenomenal. I drink a ton because it doesn't give me a headache, but over here it gives me more of a headache. So there you go.
Yeah. There's definitely a chemical. I forget the chemical's name, but it's something in there. No, it's
USA preservatives.
It's the tannins.
There is a preservative in there that actually is what gives you the headache. But anyways, I'm sure you know more about that than I do. So being a doctor and all, you know. All right. So So, Doc Kelly, can we talk about the Red Sox? Well, you know what? What made you become a doctor?
I tried out a bunch of other stuff first, but then, and my dad's a doctor, so it was, I had a good role model. But then I kind of realized it was sort of, for me, the ultimate challenge of, like, there's some science in there. There's a lot of humanities. But the kind of doctoring I wanted to do, it was kind of like ER or surgery was what I was thinking about, because I like a lot of the action and procedural. And so, you know, using your hands, fixing stuff. And a lot of it is sort of, it's like a puzzle. It's like detective work, trying to figure out and diagnose and treat. But it's very real and practical. So it had a lot of different challenges involved. And I sort of liked people. So I figured, you know, working with people was something that'd be interesting. But I tried a whole bunch of different stuff through, you know, high school and college. And I actually ended up doing all my pre-med stuff really late, like in my late junior year and senior year.
I like how you put in like the, all the different thought process. Nobody's ever answered it that way that I've heard. You know, usually when you're, oh, a doctor, the medical side of things, I love science, but like the humanity side and then the whole puzzle piece, like, I don't think everybody really thinks of it always that way. So I think that was a really good description of like really what a true doctor does. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, tons of different doctors are different in different ways, just like we all are. And there's lots of different specialties. So to me, though, I was never going to be like a super researcher just working in a tower, just doing like straight up science. It was always the practical side of science that got me interested. So that's just a different spin on it.
And how long have you been practicing in the ER now?
So I did my residency 97 to 2000. And then I stayed next year to do like a chief year and attending year. So I guess it's been since 1997. Okay. And then I kind of came out fully in, you know, trained and everything in 2000.
So 20 years. You kind of get numb to stuff after doing it for that long. Is there any like specific nights though, or days that you kind of hold on to that were like extra crazy or extra insane that you can look back or you can think like immediately, like, I remember that night?
Yeah, there's a lot. So if you guys, speaking of good movies, you ever see Saving Private Ryan?
Yeah.
Phenomenal.
So you remember like when everything kind of comes ahead of the machine gun nest and they're all talking to each other and they're starting to fight with each other and like threaten to shoot each other. And Tom Hanks is like, I just don't know how I can tell my wife about days like this. Remember, yes. He kind of has that line where he's like, I don't know how I can tell her about this. Yeah, there's a lot of times when you come out of a shift in the ER, and this is true for the nurses as much or more than for us because they get to know the patients really well. But there are plenty of days when you come out of there and you're just like, someone's like, hey, how's your day? You know, and you're like, oh, I can't even answer that to you because there's some things that you're, you know, doing and dealing with both on the upside, but definitely on the downside where, you know, things get pretty real. And you know, I guess the best way I can describe it is like all the stuff we're going through right now is very obviously like the whole world sort of is a little sick to its stomach right now with what's going on. Right. And it's in your face all the time. Well, there are a lot of days in the ER where that's sort of your world. It's just that the rest of the world's fine. And, you know, you walk out and it's a bright, sunny day. But in there was some, you know, pretty incredible stuff happening, like high drama, you know, both great stuff sometimes and sometimes some pretty awful stuff. So there are countless days that and countless patients and, you know, scenarios that I remember incredibly well. And, you know, it's not, there's a lot of it that's incredibly impactful one way or another. And, you know, in a weird way, sometimes the ones that are more difficult or the worse outcomes, people remember you more for how you delivered bad news or got them through a particularly bad moment than the miraculous saves where everything ended up being more of a happy ending. And, you know, it's just sometimes you kind of mentioned the humanity of it, but like sometimes actually just being honest and helping someone through a time when it wasn't so great, they actually remember that. And I've seen patients come back, you know, 10, 15 years later that remember it. And I remember them. You usually remember these people. So,
which is kind of important, right? Because as an ER doc, you don't have a patient list per se that like a recurring patient. It's always like they come in, you treat them, and they kind of go on their way, unless if, you know, certain circumstances. Yeah. So that would be the difference in that scenario, right?
Yeah, it's funny. And I actually ran a concierge practice for a while where we use technology to do home visits. And so I've been in that experience where I've had patients for longer periods, for years, and you do get to know them, and it's great. But I will say that, and maybe part of this just, I don't know if it's my personality selecting my career or the career creating my personality, you know, chicken or the egg. But either way, I will say that it doesn't take long to make a really significant connection with people or with patients. And in the ER, I might see 20 or 30 new patients, but pretty quickly connect with them. And in some ways, it's because they've self-selected for times in their life that was actually really important. And so a lot of the small talk and the noise goes away when someone's having a stroke or someone's really distressed and, you know, about their family member. You can cut to the chase pretty quickly if you know what you're doing and if you like to connect to people on that level. And so I think I've gotten to know people almost better, you know, in 10 or 15 minutes than a lot of people who have professional relationships with patients or others for a lifetime. And that's because they're in a moment that's just an absolutely, you know, self-selected, incredible moment in their life, both usually in a bad way. Yeah. But when someone helps them through that, you know, you get to, you bond, right? So I never missed that whole, you know, not seeing people every 6 months or every year. And I had that for parts of the other practice that I started. But in the ER, I that's maybe, again, part of this is the personality of a lot of ER doctors. Like, we enjoy having the most important people, the most important time in people's lives selected for us. And you make the most impact you can, and then you move on to the next patient. And if you, you know, if you do it right, then people aren't offended by that. They're psyched. They're like, okay, you did what you could for me, and you've explained that, and now I'm going to go see a surgeon, or I'm going back to my doctor. But I thank you for getting through that part where you're trained to help me with that.
Yeah, I can see how it cuts through that, all that superficial stuff, like, very quickly, and you can build that bond a lot quicker, as opposed to like a everyday life when you know we just are who we are. Yeah. You know, kind of take a long time to build any type of relationship or anything like that.
I think in that they're a very vulnerable moment, really. So you kind of open up a little more, I think.
Yeah, because everything's an emergency, right? I mean, that's the name of the place, emergency department, right?
Or so you would hope so.
It's emergency by their definition, right? And, you know, certainly sometimes an emergency is they can't see their doctor and they're coming in for something. And so I don't want to give you the idea that it's all super high drama like Grey's Anatomy or whatever, but in general, like, it selects for stuff that is important to people. And there's a scale, right? I mean, there's some things that are off the scale and they're incredibly, you know, emergent. And there are other things that we would, you know, we're sort of not so impressed by how emergent it is. But like you said, by definition, they think it's important enough to come to you at 2 a.m. It's important, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What if it's important to, like, that said person's wife that you go to the ER, but then you're like, I can wait till the morning, like, it's fine. Like,
I feel like are you asking? Yeah. Are you asking for?
This is not a
friend
situation. Like, yeah. Yeah. Tell your friend, happy wife, happy life.
Okay. All right. Or if I'm telling, like it's not that bad of a cut. Let's just put some super glue in it. We don't really need stitches. Like, that's not that big of a deal, right?
That's a good point. In fact, a lot of times all we use is just Dermabond, which is medical grade super glue.
Yeah, and I got the stuff from the Dollar Tree, so I mean,
it's the same thing.
Just irrigate the heck out of it first, and you're good.
Okay. All right. Good.
All right. Good. Good.
Good to know.
I say good and shrug my shoulders as if I understand what you mean by irrigate, but I assume that just means let it bleed
wash
a little
it.
Bit.
Wash
So, Dr. Kelly, as you know, we're all remote, right, due to this whole COVID situation. What is your take? Because I feel like, me personally, like, I'm kind of conflicted on the whole COVID thing in regards to, obviously, the medical community wants us to be at home, stay at home. And I feel that that's important, right? That's really important to stay at home. But then, like, part of it, like, as a society, we're built in a certain way where, right, we have, our insurances are through our employers, right? So if you have COVID, people need to stay home. I totally agree with that. However, there's like a balance that needs to happen for folks to continue to be able to work and continue to have insurance, et cetera. Because otherwise they could get hurt or die from other medications because they can't treat them, et cetera. I mean, what is, I know it's like a very broad question, but what is your thoughts on our current situation?
Enormously complex topic, obviously. Yeah. So first of all, do the isolation thing for now, because what it's saving us from is going way over the edge of our capacity in our hospitals, because like it or not, there are a certain percentage of people that get COVID-19 that get really, really sick and they are dying. And most of them are older, but there are some younger people. And truthfully, none of those people, we should be able to save a lot of them. But for some reason, there's something about this virus and we don't want to get too far down that rabbit hole. But we haven't figured it out yet, like how to treat those really sick people to prevent them from dying, or how to inoculate the population, vaccinate them, or somehow prevent this, right? So what you're really trying to do is prevent, you know, you've all heard flattening the curve and preventing from getting over capacity. The real problem is that we don't have the capacity in our healthcare system to tolerate much of this. That's the real problem, is that we don't, you know, we didn't plan for this like we could have. We weren't as prepared as we could have been, despite the fact that in the past, we've actually had experts predicting there will be a pandemic. The CDC had this process called Agent X, where they said there will be something like this. And they actually guessed that it might be a coronavirus that, you know, is zoonosis. It crosses over from an animal, and it's so unlike other stuff that our body's immune system can't fight it properly. So there are a lot of experts predicted this, and a lot of people that said, hey, you actually need to create an infrastructure or maintain an infrastructure that has a stockpile of things like protective gear for people that are, you know, seeing patients, that has things like a lot of supplies for testing so that we can get back to work and figure out who's actually immune to this and who's not, and organized infrastructure around, if this happens, then this is what we are going to do. The FDA, you know, others can say, the CDC, the WHO, they can coordinate and say, look, this is what's going on. Here's how we're going to attack this from an infrastructure and a standardized, you know, platform. This is how we want to proceed. None of that's happening right now. I'm sure you guys don't want to get into politics too much, but it is, there's not a lot of good things happening right now as far as organizing the response. So right now, unfortunately, one of the only kind of ways we can address this is to try to socially isolate, which I hate that term. I think it should be physical distancing and isolation, not social. I think human beings are social. You need to do things like this, right? So that's just an aside, an editorial. But the physical separation is necessary to limit the amount of spread right now so it doesn't overwhelm the system. Now, the problem is it doesn't stop it from spreading. It just slows it down, which means all you're doing is prolonging the pain somewhat. But believe me, you don't want to get into the situation where you have the need for 50,000 ICU beds when you have 5,000. Because then you're talking about putting four patients on the same ventilator and choosing which ones will not get ventilated and which ones will die. So that will be my decision if we don't stay home. So we do need to do what we're doing right now. But the thing that gets me really angry is the whole reason we're doing this is to try to delay things so that science and technology can actually help. And a lot of smart people want to work on this, but a lot of people working at cross purposes. So the federal government right now is falling flat on its fucking face, as far as I'm concerned. Sorry for the F-bomb.
Okay. That's okay.
It's true. So right now there are things that are happening, like Massachusetts as a state and hospitals are going out there trying to procure protective equipment for people like me to go see patients. They finally had some contracts, and suddenly the federal government comes swooping in and says, well, we'll go out there and buy up all these PPE. We'll get N95 masks. We'll pay $5 each for them. So guess what happens to the contract of 1 million masks that the hospital was supposed to get for $3 per mask? That distributor now says, oh, well, the government's going to buy it up. So they're literally now being diverted to some federal supply when it was about ready to get into the hospital's hands. So there's like, it's not wrong for the federal government to come in and try to buy up a supply, but we should have had a supply to begin with. And now that we start trying to get a supply, you got to coordinate. So you're not actually taking it now and making it worse. And that's just one example. The testing example is an incredible example. So, you know, the way this country gets back up and running, we have to test everyone. We have to test everyone because there are asymptomatic carriers that are out there infecting people that are complete. They're asymptomatic. They have no symptoms, but they can infect 7, 10, 5, 3 other people. Our kids may be in this category. It's just so we need to test everyone we can possibly test, which means that starts yesterday. We need to gear up the supply and the supply chain to do testing, to figure out everyone that's on this call. We could know if anyone actively has an infection by doing PCR or perimeter of chain reaction testing, looking for the viral RNA to see if you actually have an infection, or antibody testing. And the antibody testing is going to be key, because what that is did your body see this virus, mount an immune response, and therefore you may be completely or partially immune to this. So you talk about, Larry, going back to work. Right now, all we're doing is totally guessing. We have no idea who's had it, who doesn't have it. Even if you tested positive or negative, those sensitivity and specificities, it's complicated whether you actually had it or not. If it was negative, you may have actually had it and it was a false negative. So we're guessing in the dark right now.
Yeah.
It's a very blunt instrument, but we have technology that can actually do this. Like, we just have to distribute it, like be more like, you know, agile about how we do this as a country. Like, we can do it. It's not like the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918. Like, we have technology, we can figure this out. But in order to do it, test everyone. And if you know, so if we know right now, if I knew all you guys, like of you guys, 3 of you have antibodies, why can't you go back to work?
Right.
We might be able to. We got to figure out how much it mutates every year, but then it may become more like the flu. Once you've seen it, once your body's at least seen a coronavirus, even if it mutates, when it comes back, it might just give you the sniffles. It may not actually mutate so much that it becomes a fresh wave of all these really bad death rates and everything. So
I was wondering about that. Like when that does happen with the flu, right? When it mutates, I wasn't sure if that was going to be true of corona. Where like if it does mutate, is it that your body has already seen it and so it's not so bad? So then if that is the case, right? Because there's other versions of corona, which is why corona 19 is very specific. Could they have been creating vaccines of the other coronas?
Yep.
And in theory, we could have seen a version of this corona. And so 19 comes along and it doesn't hit us as bad. Is that a theory, or
is that how the asymptomatic happens?
It's possible.
So you're asking a lot of great questions, which have really complicated answers. And a lot of the answers we actually don't know right now,
right.
But I'll separate out a few things. For every virus, there's at least 3 factors that are really important. One is like, how infectious is it, right? So in other words, let's say one of us has it. There's just statistically, depending on how hardy the virus is and the host and the other conditions, temperature, there's a ton of things that go into it, how close we all are. There's an infectivity kind of ratio called rho. So it's like, in other words, if one person has it, how many other people will get it from that one person? And if that's over 2, it becomes exponential, because you're, you know, it's like that's exponential growth. Every one person gives it to 2 others and it goes higher. Once you can get that level down, so certain viruses are more infective than others. And you just don't know until empirically you look and you see statistically, how much is this one? And it has to do with the virus itself, the host, there's a whole bunch of things. But in general, how infectious is it? Because if it's super infectious and everyone gets it, but it's not deadly, then that means it'll go viral. Everyone, lots of people will get it, but maybe they won't get sick from it. So that other most important factor is how deadly it is. So it's how infectious is it, and how likely are you to give it to others and for it to spread? How viral is it? There's a term viral, which we all throw around. Well, that's what it's from. Viruses go viral. They're good at this. This is all they do, right? This is what they do. Welcome to it. So how viral it is, how infectious is it, but then how deadly is it? Like, how sick does it make people? And that's the piece here that's a bit scary, is because it's deadlier than your other like a usual kind of flu epidemic. Now, flu pandemics, when a flu goes around the world because it mutates so much, it's different. And the last time that had a significant one was back in 1918. Those are very deadly, probably almost on the order of what this will be. We'll see what the numbers end up being. But anyhow, it's like, how infectious is it? And then how deadly is it?
Now, right? Do you think like the when they look back at statistics from even this year, like next year, mm-hmm. like the row, you know, because they're going to want to know mm-hmm. that, right? Now, Will, do you think the social distancing will affect that statistic, though?
So, yes. So that's exactly what you're trying to do, is you're trying to bring that number down and cause it not to infect so people as much.
It really
so,
won't
yes,
give
it's...
us an accurate representation, then, right?
No,
what
but
the
if
row
you,
really
but
it, is.
No, but if you look at it, like we have the ability to look and see, you can see places that did social distancing more or less. You can look at population. We have so much technology.
I mean, think
about what our own company does, right? I mean, you know, think about Google and Apple doing contact tracing and other places doing contact tracing. We all have cell phones right now that can tell us where we all were. So, you know, again, it's not 1918. We have technology. Now, are there privacy concerns? Are there data concerns? Absolutely. But there are these are somewhat more answerable questions if you go at it scientifically and methodically, right? And then so the other piece you asked about, Larry, or someone asked, how much does it mutate? And therefore, how much does that immunity help you if it comes around again? And usually it's not 100%, it's not 0%. Usually it's something in between. And that's why from, you know, you think about the flu is very infectious. It's not as deadly. It's still deadly. What drives doctors and nurses crazy is nobody cared about the flu, but it was still killing 100,000 people a year, right? We couldn't be bothered to get a flu vaccine, but now with Corona, we're all terrified of it. Well, the truth is, a flu is pretty deadly. It's not as deadly as this, but it was still deadly. It's certainly infectious, and it mutates. So that's why every year when it comes back around, what they're doing is it's somewhat temperate. So what they're doing when they analyze a flu vaccine and try to make one is in each hemisphere, they're actually looking at the other hemisphere, seeing which way it mutated and trying to guess where it's going to mutate to try to get it. So it's as close to what it would look like in real life. So what a vaccine is essentially it's something that is either artificially made that looks chemically like the virus, or it's actually a live virus, which is attenuated. It's like neutered kind of, and it doesn't make you sick, but it is the virus itself or something similar that your body, your immune system can see and say, hey, that's no good. If that comes by, I'm going to be ready to go to attack that thing. And so that's what immunity is and what a vaccine is. So you either get infected with the real thing and your body now develops an immune response. It knocks it down. Hopefully you survive it. The next time it comes around, if it looks exactly the same, your body kicks in and shuts that thing down because it recognizes that as immune now. But
now,
if the thing mutates,
sorry.
Yeah. If we, like, I know, like, the flu vaccine, the flu obviously has mutated multiple times with coronaviruses because a lot of people compare the two through all this. Do they, and we might, I don't know if we even know the answer, maybe not this one, but the other ones, do they not mutate as frequent or as much or drastically?
We don't know whether this is going to mutate more or less than the flu. It is mutating. We just don't know how significant that is clinically. Okay. The reality is this is just me guessing. It should never be as bad as it is now because it's as different as it could ever look to us first time around.
Okay. Yeah.
It came from a bat or wherever it came from. It's unlike anything. I mean, it's a coronavirus, but it looks different than anything else. It's acting differently than other things. So right now is hopefully the worst case scenario because it's sweeping around and nobody's really seen. Well, I mean, maybe somebody's seen something like it, but very few people have seen anything. Their immune systems have seen anything like it so that they're immune enough to fight it off like completely. Now, even that being said, I personally think there are a boatload of people in this country and around the world who have been exposed to it, had no symptoms or very mild symptoms, and have gotten better. And therefore, you know, the death statistics are skewed a lot because you don't know the denominator. We only know the people that have been tested. And we talked earlier, we're doing so woefully few tests. For a long time, we were only testing people who were, you know, had visited or got exposed to someone who's from the Wuhan province in China when it was probably in our community spreading already. And even now, we're not testing people at the rate where we want to. So there's probably a huge percentage. I mean, I think 30% of the population has already had this.
Oh, well, I was going to ask you. That's what I was going to ask, predict. Like, what do you think that, or how far back do you feel like it's already been?
I think if that's going to come out, it's going to be a quarter to a third of the population probably had this thing.
Wow.
When all is said and done.
How many tests do you think?
That's a complete guess.
Yeah, of course.
But it's an answerable problem. This is what drives people like me crazy. We have pharma, state, every pharma, every doctor, most like even the federal government, everyone wants to do this. We can't get our act together to have the federal government outline an attack plan that involves pharma and the states and just do it. Like here are the three or four approved, FDA approved antibody tests. Here are the ones that are the PCR tests looking at viruses. Here's the program. Here's how we do it.
So as a simpleton, why wouldn't we use the World Health Organization's tests?
You're gonna have to ask the CDC and the Trump administration. Okay. That.
Okay.
I would have used them. Generally, what happens is, again, these are enormously complex issues, but generally the CDC will look at the WHO test or whatever other test and generally do a good job of deciding, like, here are our standards. Like, here's what we think needs to happen, and we want to actually make the best test out there. And we used to have a reputation that we were really good at things like that. But in my opinion, over the past, you know, 4 or 8 years even, we've sort of dismantled a lot of the parts of government for whatever reason, because, you know, there are a lot of reasons, but a lot of the different parts of government that were actually surveilling this and looking at disaster response and epidemiologic responses, we've dismantled a lot of that infrastructure. And so a lot of the people that normally would be flying over to Wuhan and going and working with the WHO, like, those people were fired. Like, we didn't have them, and we don't really have them. A decision was made at the CDC to do their own test. They did a test. What happened was, it sounds like the latest stuff that comes out is that they had the two channels on the test that normally the WHO had. They made a third channel as a quality control check. That was a control so that you could say there was no virus in this part. So therefore you can, you know, let's say a positive turns blue. This, I don't know how this one works, but you need to know, you know, is that truly positive or is it a false positive because the whole test is turning blue? So you make a negative channel that basically has no virus in it, and that should be the whatever the control is that is negative. The problem is they were all turning positive because it sounds like they were cross-contaminated in the lab. So the lab and the CDC, they just didn't follow their own protocol, and they contaminated those negative channels, the control channels, with virus, like with, you know, stuff that would turn it positive. So now you had all these doctors and other people out there seeing a test where the control, which was supposed to be negative, was turning positive. So now you don't know if you can trust that test.
That sounds awesome.
So not only do we not have the right test that was made correctly, we have nowhere near enough of them.
Yeah.
So anyway, okay. It's just, and this is all stuff that we'll continue to work on and continue to come out. But to my mind, like, if you boil it all down, you don't want to get lost in the noise. Just simplify it. You want to get the world back, test everyone. You got to test virtually everyone. Now, statistically, you can start with, you know, vulnerable populations, people like me who go into the ER to see people, grocery store workers, you know, essential workers and supply chain people. Test all of us. Test all of us. Was I already exposed? Do I have immunity to it? And do I have any active symptoms, or am I shedding the virus? So test me with both. And if I'm negative, then I should be back in the ER seeing patients. If someone else is not, then we have to be even more careful. Maybe they get most of the PPE if we have limited rationale of that.
Absolutely. Now, the asymptomatic folks, I've heard that that percentage could be pretty high, right? Like, as far as like people who are actually asymptomatic, like I've heard numbers like 25% being thrown out.
Yeah. Again, all preliminary data. This is, again, why you want to coordinate research, because you've got a bunch of people working on their own little pet projects. And some of them, you know, like if they're going to test things like how many people are asymptomatic or which drugs work, you know, a simple case of the hydroxychloroquine, they're touted as a drug that could work. Well, what dose are you using? How long are you using it? Are you using it before they get sick, during they get sick? You know, when they get really sick, only in the ICU? And you've got all these little studies doing different things. Like, that all has to be coordinated. So if you coordinate it and say, okay, look, you know, Yale, you answer these questions, right? Harvard, you answer these questions. You know, Kentucky, you do these questions. And then you systematically can coordinate and come up with a better answer to say, okay, let's, you know, you're going to look into the prevalence of, you know, how many times asymptomatic people can infect other people by doing surveillance. And there are certain countries doing this, like Germany's doing a lot of this, where they're saying, okay, you know, they're just testing people who were captured for some other reason in the hospital. So, you know, one little study came out where they just happened to be doing flu swabs on a bunch of pregnant women in the hospital, not symptomatic for COVID-19 or anything, but they're just doing flu swabs, viral swabs, and they realized they could go back and do COVID-19 tests on them, and a significant percentage were positive, and many of them were completely asymptomatic. So that is a good data point that would support what you've heard, which is there are probably a lot of people out there who, if you just happen to be able to get testing on them, were asymptomatic but actually did have virus that they could have been shedding.
All right.
So,
wow. Yeah.
Do you think that, when do you think is it appropriate time to stop the social distancing? Is it a number of tests per day, or is it a number of like cases per day that are tested positive, or what do you feel like as a doctor is an appropriate time to stop or at least ease the restrictions that we have now?
So everything in medicine is about like risk versus benefit, or, you know, advantages versus disadvantages. And obviously social distancing has enormous disadvantages. So I'd be in favor of stopping it or easing it as soon as possible. What does that mean? Well, first of all, you have to make sure that your hospitals are not still being overwhelmed by a surge of patients. So the first thing that needs to happen is we have to get through this wave. And Massachusetts is right in the middle of it. Boston's right in the middle of this kind of surge. You can track that by the number of new cases being reported and by deaths. Deaths usually lag 1 to 2 weeks behind the number of new cases. And that makes sense, right? It takes people a week or two to get sick enough where they actually pass away on this. So there's a leading indicator, which is the number of confirmed cases. But we've just said we're having trouble because we're not testing enough people. So you got to be careful about that. People that get sick enough get hospitalized. So you can look at that as kind of your second data point. And then your third is how many people are dying. And then your fourth might be how many are recovering. And hopefully you see the recovery curve go up, you know, more so than the people getting sick. So it's the number of new cases per day that's probably the leading indicator. It's the deaths per day that show you whether you're kind of hitting the plateau. We're probably in the middle of it now. So the first thing needs to happen is that stuff needs to be trending even or coming down. Because if it's still trending up and you release the social isolation, we're going to keep going up. And then we're going to overwhelm our resources even more. So we got to ride it where we stay just below it. And if it starts to head down, then we have the conversation about, well, how can we start to relax social distancing? And even when we do that, doing it in a way that makes sense, people are going to be more conscious. I don't think we're going to be going, you know, like sports, for example, like, you know, I don't think we're going to be filling up Fenway Park anytime soon, but could we maybe get baseball back for TV contracts? Like, let's talk about that, right? Let's talk about, you know, maybe if people start to get tested and realize, look, there's a certain percentage out there. It's called herd immunity. If you have a certain percentage of people that have already been exposed, it's harder for the virus to spread around because people aren't getting sick and then coughing it all over other people again. So it's a really long answer, but the short answer is first you got to get over this wave and then you can at least talk about it, which is why I'm aggravated because I want to get everybody tested in the meantime. Start testing now or ramp up your capacity. So when we're finally ready, when we're finally ready to start answering that question, when are we allowed to go walk around and start socializing again? We're all going to shrug our shoulders like, well, let's try it, right? Well,
yeah.
It's no strategy. Like, let's try, you know.
Give it a shot.
Maybe let's blindfold ourselves and maybe there's a cliff in front of us. Let's just try going for a walk, right? Like, how about we turn on the light and look around a little first, right? So like testing. That's the, like right now, my urgency as an ER doc is like, we got to test everyone. Yeah.
I do got one more question about that, or about the whole thing, kind of. what do you feel like will stick with us as a population or as a world, even at this point? Like, one of the things, like, of reading, like, about the Spanish flu, like, one of the major things that stuck in my mind was, like, that they got rid of was communal cups. Like, not everybody went to the watering hole and all drank from the same cup anymore. Do you think there's anything, like, that's going to stick with us from this that our children, our children's children will be like, well, I can't believe they ever actually did that. You know, because we look back and think, we're not drinking from communal cups, you know? Like, that's not a thing we do.
Right. Probably handshakes.
You think so? Handshakes are done?
Yeah. I think handshakes might be a rare thing in the future.
If
you're a hugger, you're screwed.
Oh.
That's the silver lining right there, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would do it just to make people uncomfortable.
Yes,
so I didn't need coronavirus to make me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, you brought that up, and I didn't even think about that because I was like, some of the things I thought about, you know, masks, obviously, you know, I feel like hand sanitizer, you know, if you can find it, it's like everywhere, you know, it's like the precious gem right now. But like, yeah, I didn't think about. Yeah, I could definitely see handshakes just going. At least dipping way down.
Yeah, and do you? I feel like they're gonna be flying with a Clorox wipe
over there. Yeah, I guess what you're saying.
Yeah, in their bag.
With that, like, with kind of the piggyback off of Corey's question, like, I know people have always, you know, now they're gonna definitely probably wash their hands more and stuff like that. Do you feel like because of this and the us being so focused on being, you know, distanced and sanitized, do you feel like that'll affect flu in the future too? Like, will those maybe trickle down, or will that not really cross paths
No, I absolutely think it will. I mean, I think we're gonna, I don't want to under or over react to this, I guess. And it's hard. It's almost like we're doing both at the same time in some ways, right? These are really strange and difficult times. I think in the end, we're going to look back and realize it was both worse, but not as bad as we thought. And when you actually look at the actual numbers, like the death statistics, it'll be bad, but I don't think it's as bad as we think. I think a lot more people had it and were exposed and had a mild case or no symptoms. And so it's worse than anything we've ever seen in our lifetime. It's changed society and culture and the economy more than anything we could have predicted. So it's by definition horrible.
Yeah.
But how do we live with it? Because we're human beings. Like, people will become acclimated to this. Like, we're not going to be freaking out about this nearly as much next year. Like, right. And hopefully we'll get off our butts and do stuff about it. Because we actually have a lot of tools to fight this and improve things in society that maybe had a chance to be improved already. So this is sort of an impetus for change, right? Like, you know, like telehealth. Like we should all be doing much more telehealth. Like, it was silly that we didn't do it before. Like, there's a lot of parts of medicine where you don't want to bring people who might be infected in with a bunch of other people that have cancer and are immunocompromised and get them infected. I mean, that's just kind of stupid what we've been doing. Like we all.
Yeah, it's almost silly when you think about
banking,
it.
How much banking do you do in person? Like, there's plenty of stuff that could be digital. Like, the world, like, there's a lot of technology we have that can really do really great things for people in medicine, and we'll start using that more.
Well, not only that, but then it's just easier for people to get to see their doctor as well, right? Because, like, if I'm elderly, I may not have a ride, I may not have you know, a way to get to see a doctor. But hey, Sean, I are you pressed for time right now? I want to be respectful of your time.
Oh yeah, we can go soon. This is good. Been a good conversation.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Good.
With that, then, go ahead.
No, I did want to get in real quick. So how did you get involved with Improvada then? Because we introduced you as the chief medical officer of Improvada.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a technology company. So how did you get your doctor? How do you get involved with them?
So, kind of in a roundabout way. I started a concierge business where we were doing a lot of home health and needed to do a lot of technology to make it happen. And it was interesting because we were ER doctors doing it. So we would do a lot of procedures and things right in people's houses. But at the same time, like, we really needed to be in multiple places at once. And so the only way to kind of figure out who needed care, and what we could do was to use technology to message them and to view things over, you know, an iPhone. And, you know, we had all sorts of portable technology like EKG machines and a blood draw machine we could do right at the bedside, right at the house. And so in order to do all that, it drove me to really like push the envelope using technology. And then I got a lot of our patients were like VC and private equity people that were investing in technology. So I got into all these great conversations and realized that some of these people potentially could have a bigger impact on patients and medicine in general by investing and running a company, but they needed guidance as far as like how healthcare worked. And I kind of appreciated having their guidance around marketing and, you know, business and how do you bring technology into medicine. And so my passion kind of became bridging the gap between the worlds of tech and business on the one hand, and then like the culture of medicine that I grew up in, and things that to me were obvious, like this is how workflows are, this is what we think and how we do things, to the business and tech world were like precious because they had no idea, like because they were coding in a room. And you know, it's not logical how medicine happens sometimes. So bridging that gap became like interesting to me. And that's when I met the former founder and CEO of Improvada, because that's right when Improvada pivoted into healthcare. So that became, you know, and so I came on board really to help guide some of that strategy and then build a network of clinical leaders throughout the industry to give feedback and help improve the products and the technology and everything. So.
Now, is that standard? Is that standard in tech companies to have like a doctor on board like that? Is that
not usually? I mean, there are certainly a lot of chief medical officers out there. A certain percentage of them probably still do practice, but probably not as many. You know, it's not as common.
I would feel like it's almost invaluable for like if you're setting up something in a hospital to have a doctor that's still in practice that says, "Whoa, that's not the way we do it." You know, because for me, it goes back to like the engineer gives me the drawings, but I'm like, I'm the one welding this up. It doesn't work that way. You know what I'm saying? You're saying like the engineer gives it to me because they drew it up in a CAD system. And, you know, I'm the one actually putting it together that knows how that metal, you know, fluctuates under heat and stuff. And I'm like, it doesn't work the way it did in your CAD. Like you need to do something else or this is how I'm going to do it, you know? So I would feel like just having somebody on board that's in the trenches per se is almost invaluable, you know, over just having somebody on the computer saying, no, just implement this system. It'll work fine. And then like,
yeah, you're preaching to the choir. I mean, obviously I feel like it is. So yeah. The expression is we eat our own dog food. That's the expression.
I like it.
When you're a user of the technology, there's no substitute for someone who is practical and is a user of technology to help guide how that technology can be better, you know?
Yeah.
One other thing with the Red Sox, do you have a cool story besides obviously being able to go to a World Series?
Yeah, sure. I'll tell you one. So my kids use the word literally all the time when it's not literally, but we had a literal diehard fan.
Okay.
A literal diehard fan. So we had a guy up in the stands and the call signal for us is 13, is medical. So we'd hear over the radio, I heard like, you know, security to bleachers. I forget which section it was, but security to section, whatever, in the bleachers. And I heard another one really quickly after that, like security to 7, whatever it was. And so there was a little bit of urgency. So I'm like, oh, something's going on. And then I heard, 13 to there, which is a, you know, medical come to the bleachers. And so one of our nurses responded, but I could hear it's like getting more urgent. So I started walking over there because I'm like one of the roving teams. And then there's someone in first aid who was closer. So the first aid person went over there with the nurse and the paramedics went over there, the medics. And then I heard like, you know, attending to, that's me, the ER attendings, attending to 30 to bleach or whatever. So I'm like, oh, now I got to really go. So I go over there and I guess there was this elderly guy who refused to, his oxygen had run out. And so he needs oxygen, but his oxygen run out. But his daughters couldn't get him to leave because Big Poppy was up and he wanted to watch Big Poppy. So he refused to leave, even though his oxygen was out and he was turning blue because Big Poppy was up. and then he passed out and coded. So he literally coded, was getting, so when I got there, we were pulling him off and we got him underneath the stands and ran a code on him. And fortunately, the other doc who was with me, it's normally like one of our residents, but that day, because she's a huge fan, it was an anesthesiologist. So she was there and they're very good at intubating. So she ended up intubating. We put a line in, I shocked him and we got him back. And so came around and we got him in the ambulance and he got rushed off. And it turns out he did absolutely fine. So he totally recovered. And his daughters were, and again, this is one where I followed the daughters. I talked to them after because it was such a shocking event, literally shocking again. And so the daughters were talking and they said he woke up and the first thing he asked was, "Big Poppy get a hit?" He woke up in the ER. He's like, "Did Big Poppy get a hit?" To which someone said, "Of course, Big Poppy always gets a hit," or something like that. So,
yeah. So that's all. There's a lot of stories to tell there. Dr. Kelly, we appreciate you having on. We like to end with asking our guests if they have one piece of advice they can impart on our listeners that they could put into action to better their lives or in general, or more specific if you want, whatever kind of advice you're thinking of. What would you tell our listeners? It could be connected to COVID or just life in general.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone is being a little more reflective now with COVID, right? We're all kind of sitting around thinking about things. You know, for me in the ER, we kind of have that perspective anyhow. So this is not the end of the world. Like, the world will come back. But, you know, I think I would recommend to people to remember that bad stuff and good stuff can happen at any time. So don't like take regular life for granted. But also don't freak out when things are tough too, because like, you know, the truth is somewhere probably in between. Like, you know, there's obviously bad stuff can happen all the time, but good stuff too, if you keep your eyes open. So I just say, be present, live your life. I mean, this is all stuff we already know. It's just that, you know, we're reminded a little more of it, in these times.
Absolutely. Definitely. It's a good reminder. I appreciate that.
Thanks again.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
See you guys.
Guys, as always, if you got any questions, comments, or concerns, you can email us at fullgorillalife@gmail.com.
And if you want to see what's going on with social media, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook at fullgorillalife and on Twitter at gorillafull.
Last but not least, visit our website, fullgorilla.life, and please hit subscribe on your podcast app of choice.